Harper versus Carillion Clinic and others, James D. Feynman, appellant's counsel, Paul C. Poodle, Charles L. Downs, Jr., Joseph M. Rainsberry, appellant's counsel.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, James B. Feynman from Lynchburg on behalf of Lyndon Parker. Certainly, the court has read the briefs in this matter. There were three counts. They demurred to count number one. The first position that they took was that, as a matter of law, there was not an employer-employee relationship. But later, they admitted that there was an employer-employee relationship at in the appendix at page 12. The position they then took was that, under Virginia law, they cited the Fairfax Hospital versus Curtis case and admitted that under Virginia law, there is a recognized duty by health care providers to a patient not to disclose health information given from the patient during the course of treatment without the patient's authorization, and that a violation of that duty gives rise to an action of tort. Then they went on to contend and to argue that the duty not to disclose does not extend to a duty to secure information. We contend that failure to secure information so as to allow unauthorized access and disclosure is the same thing as disclosure. We cited the Department of Health and Human Services interpretive guideline, which acknowledges this common sense fact. It says, quote, "The right to confidentiality means safeguarding the content of information, including patient records." That was in our opening brief at page 8. "The right to privacy in regard to medical records has no meaning if the healthcare provider is not required to safeguard the content of the medical records." We believe that demurrer to count one has no merit. It should be reversed. The demurrer to count two, the negligence per se count, the defense assert, quote, "The regulations of the access and discharge of an individual's health information has nothing to do with public safety. Accordingly, the plaintiff's HIPAA claim does not form a basis for negligence per se action." First, we do not have a HIPAA claim. We have a claim under Virginia law for violating state and federal statutes and regulations. The General Assembly has expressly declared in Virginia Code Section 32.1-127.1:03, quote, "There is hereby recognized an individual's right of privacy in the content of his health records." This was also, I believe, the common law that this court expressed in Pierce versus Cadet and Fairfax Hospital versus Curtis. I believe the General Assembly merely recognized what the common law was.
May I interrupt you for a second? The first assignment of error is directed at whether or not a cause of action exists in tort against the employees, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, has anyone ever recognized that? I mean, the Curtis case and the cases that Curtis cited were causes of action based upon the relationship of the parties, and the defendant was the healthcare provider. And the analogies would, of course, be to medical malpractice and professional negligence with lawyers. But ordinarily, you can't sue a secretary of a lawyer's office for legal malpractice, and you can't sue a receptionist or a mailroom clerk of a doctor for medical malpractice. So what's your basis for asserting that Davis and Young could individually be sued and thus, for purposes of respondeat superior, present vicarious liability for the employer?
Well, in the Pierce versus Cadet case, which preceded the Fairfax Hospital case, I believe this court did refer to any health care provider or their employee can be held liable for the unauthorized disclosure of health information. That was in Pierce versus Cadet. I think this court did refer to that and state that. I don't believe, as Your Honor points out, that in the Fairfax case that issue arose, so I don't think it was excluded in the Fairfax case.
But in Pierce, the statement that was being made is that the healthcare provider can be sued for its violations as well as the violations of those under its control, but it didn't say you could sue the mail clerk or the secretary or the receptionist individually.
Well, I think when the General Assembly has passed the statute that I just referred to, I can give you the quote, I'm sure you know it, but the, you know, when there is the right to privacy, there is hereby recognized an individual's right to privacy, the content of his or her health records. I do think that...
But your claim is a tort claim under Curtis. It's not an implied right of action claim under the statute.
I didn't hear the second thing.
Your claim is a tort claim under Curtis. It is not a statutory implied right of action. And Curtis is against the health care provider. It's not against the receptionist of the health care provider or whomever.
I think that, that what you're saying about Curtis is correct, but I do think that the Pierce versus Cadet case said that this court could easily find that a health care provider or any one of its employees would be liable in tort for unauthorized disclosure of medical information. I believe this court said that.
I think the quote was that the healthcare provider can be liable for disclosures by itself or those under its control, i.e. its employees. That's not saying the employees can be personally liable. It's saying the healthcare provider can be vicariously liable, which is pretty standard.
But, well, I agree with that, Your Honor, that there's vicarious liability. This court did not originally accept the assignments of error number one. It then, shortly before the last time oral argument said, it issued another ruling that it was accepting that.
Where did the trial court even make the ruling that you indicate in assignment of error one?
Where did the trial court make the ruling?
Right. Where in the record is it? Is there a trial court ruling on this point that you raise in assignment of error one?
I don't know that there's, I can't point to any place in the record exactly to say that. I can't point to that. But what the trial court...
And the employees were not served in this case.
That's correct. But what the trial court did was say, you know, we're going to find that, you know, the demur, that the demur to all counts is sustained, and that's what they did. So the vicarious liability in the, on the part of the health care providers is essential to the case.
But that's also in assignment of error three. That's where you have the respondeat superior claim is actually in three. Doesn't appear to be a ruling that is supported by assignment of error one. But it's still in the case because it's in three.
Yes, sir. That's correct. That is correct. The existence of an employer-employee relationship creates a prima facie rebuttable presumption of the employer's liability. The employer-employee relationships here were admitted in the answer shown in appendix at page 12 of the appendix. We believe, as a matter of law, on the holding in Davis versus Merrill, malicious assaults based on lack of judgment, infirmity of temper, or the influence of passion makes an employer liable even if the employee went beyond his strict line of duty and authority in inflicting such injury. And in the Davis versus Merrill case, the employer was held to be liable for a guard who shot into a car. And we assert that when an employee wrongfully discloses confidential health information, as a matter of law, an employee who by virtue of their employment is able to access and wrongfully disclose confidential information.
Right, so they have to be acting within the scope of their employment, right?
Well, no, I think that they are.
I understand you think they are, and that conclusory allegation was made. But then if you look at the other specific allegations, it seems clear to me that they were not performing any duties as employees at Carilion when they were doing this and when they were accessing the information. They weren't doing it in the execution of services to Carilion. Can you show me allegations that would indicate that other than the conclusory allegation that you made?
Well, I think it's fair to infer from the complaint that the first employee who was sitting at the receptionist desk saw Ms. Parker come in, knew that Ms. Parker was a romantic rival of her friend's. She looked into the medical information system solely by virtue of her employment as a receptionist, and went into it and accessed it and then wrongfully disclosed it to her friend that were mad at my client. So I do think that a rebuttable presumption is raised under
But how is that doing accessing the information within the scope of duties and services for Carilion?
The question is whether in service of her employer the tort occurred. She was sitting at the receptionist desk and acting.
So as long as she's at work, she's performing services for Carilion.
Well, I don't know what I think in the facts that I've said, when you're a receptionist and you see a patient comes in who you know is a romantic rival of your friend, and then by virtue of your position as the receptionist, you have access to the hospital health information system, you access that improperly, then you are doing that. The tort has occurred within the service of your employment. Just like the guard in Davis versus Merrill, when the guard started shooting at the car, obviously that was in no way in furtherance of the interests of the employer, but it happened while he was at his station serving as the guard for the employer, and this court clearly and forcibly held that that creates respondeat
superior. Well, in this case, what is the tort? Is the tort the access that you believe that Carilion should have somehow prohibited or inhibited, or is it the dissemination? What's the tort?
Well, I think it's both. I would say at this point in time it's both. Without perhaps realizing what the distinction would mean, but I think the damages. I think it's improper to access it, and it's clearly improper to disclose it.
Well, the damages come from the dissemination.
I agree.
But you couldn't have the dissemination without the access that was independently obtained.
I'm trying to figure out, just practically speaking, how this would work for a hospital or a medical provider, because you need the, everybody has these satellite clinics now,
right?
I mean, I'm in Spotsylvania. There's a UVA, clinic there.
Okay.
And so the patient might come into the mothership for treatment, but then the follow-up care is going to be nearby or whatever. So, are courts the right place to police this kind of, computer, technical, security business?
Absolutely.
You think so?
Absolutely. I think this court has already held that, and I think that all of us are in grave danger if the courts do not do this.
In other words, if the tort is the unauthorized dissemination, that's one thing. If the tort is, let's get into how you run your computer security and figure out if that was adequate or not, that seems like a different animal to me.
Well, I think the duty not to disclose obviously includes the duty to protect or safeguard the content. You just can't leave a record open for anybody to look at. I think that's part and parcel of it. I don't think you can really legitimately distinguish it.
Okay.
So I would reserve the time unless people have. Unless All right. The court has more questions.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Charles Downs from Roanoke, and I have the pleasure of representing Carilion Clinic in this matter. We are here on a ruling from a demur, so the facts are important, and some of the facts discussed by my colleague are not in the complaint. What is alleged in the complaint is that Ms. Parker sought treatment at a Carilion facility. It's alleged in the complaint that Ms. Davis, an employee of Carilion, accessed her record inappropriately.
Let's stop right there. Why? What purpose would there be for Carilion to allow a receptionist to get into the substance of a patient's
record? Well, Your Honor, it's not in the record that she was a receptionist. It's not in the record at all of what her duties were. There's no mention in the record. It's only that she is an employee of Carilion. She could have been a registered nurse. She could have been a licensed professional nurse. She could have been a receptionist. it's simply
she not. Just wasn't. No, I'm just joking.
She was not, as alleged, she was inappropriately in the record. That there has to be some service she's performing related to this access of the record, which is not alleged in the complaint.
But isn't there a long-standing presumption of the scope of employment simply from the proof of employment? In other words, an employer and employee, there's a presumption that the work they do is within the scope of their employment. It's rebuttable, to be sure, and it, obviously on a demur, if the plaintiff themselves provides the rebuttal in their pleadings, then it's subject to demur. But other than that, doesn't it survive demur simply because of the presumption?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and I believe this court has ruled that whether or not an employee is acting for the employer in the furtherance of their job is a question of law that can be determined on demur, as it was in this case. We simply don't have those facts that, so when the first employee...
Stop just a moment. You just got through saying, well, we don't know if she was a nurse, a valet parker, a doorkeeper. If you don't know that, how could you do it as a matter of law?
Because it's not alleged, Your Honor. It has to be alleged. Mrs. Parker knows by going to the facility in what capacity she interacted with Ms. Davis.
So your point is that the failure of the plaintiff to identify the role of the employee makes it insufficient as a matter of law, and the demur was proper.
Correct, Your Honor. But taken one step further, there is no allegation in the complaint. It's completely silent as to what Ms. Davis was doing for Carillion at the time she accessed the
But record. I think you're missing the point. The pleading presumption is all you have to plead initially is the relationship, the employment relationship. The burden of proof then falls upon the employer to prove it's outside the, not arising out of in the course of employment, which you arguably have a very strong case on based upon the allegations. The only issue for demur, as the Chief just laid out, is are the allegations of this complaint self-defeating? In other words, do they do the job for you? Which is, yeah, she did this as a personal motive that obviously was nothing for the employer's benefit in any of this, whoever she was, whether she was a valet or a receptionist, or whatever. Do you see where we are with the argument?
No, understood, Your Honor. I certainly do. And I think once the employer-employee relationship is noted in the complaint, as it is in this clearly, understanding then the presumption goes to the defendant. Except in this case, the complaint, and as this court has ruled, it is insufficient because there has to be more, even in the demur stage, than just asserting magic words of an employer-employee relationship.
But why does that have to be the case? Why? I don't know if you're responding to the question that's being asked. How do they plead themselves out of the presumption? Or have they pled themselves out of the presumption? What paragraphs, what assertions plead them out of the presumption?
It's the information that's not provided in the complaint, Your Honor, that pleads them out of the presumption.
Well, once they say there is an employment relationship and the presumption attaches, what more do they need to say to survive?
I think there has to be something in the pleading, facts in the pleading, that assert that the employee is doing something related to the service of the employer.
But it's one thing if the complaint says, well, while at Walmart, they, you know, had this, you know, physical altercation or something, and the person happens to be employed by your client. But it's in the context of coming in for care, right? That's what the complaint says.
Certainly, Your Honor, it is in the context. She's coming in for care for something wholly unrelated to her private diagnosis. But the employee there has to be something in the pleading that says that the employee is executing the service for which she was employed.
What's the basis for that statement?
Well, I think that comes out of the Gina Chin case, Your Honor, and I think it's paramount.
But the Gina Chin case indicated that you can actually be within the scope of your employment, but doing something that is contrary to what your employer has told you to do.
Absolutely, Your Honor, except Gina Chin also stands for the proposition that you are executing the service of the employer. There has to be some execution of service. I have to be doing something that I'm employed
okay,
for.
Let's presume hypothetically. I could presume hypothetically that Ms. Davis was a doctor. But let's presume hypothetically that Ms. Davis is a receptionist. Okay, just for the purpose of this little discussion. Let's presume she's a receptionist. Let's presume that as a receptionist, she has access to the computer.
Correct, Your Honor.
And because she has access to the computer, she can get deep into the database. Now, at that point, respondeat superior would apply, would it not?
By providing access to
the computer. She is in the facility of the employer. She is sitting at the desk the employer has provided. She is accessing the computer that the employer has provided, and she is in the database that the employer has given her access to. Now, at that point, the Gina Chin ruling comes in, and she might be doing something contrary to what her employer has told her to do. She might hypothetically be accessing the private medical records of a romantic rival.
Correct. And Your Honor, if she is in fact, you can have access to the record that is inappropriate. But yes, if part of her job duties are to access records of folks as they come in, then certainly I would agree with the court that the Gina Chin case law attaches to the facts of this case. And she is at that point executing the service for which she is employed. The complaint in this case is simply void of that information.
It's a subtle topic, to be sure, but the quote that is the preeminent quote for this is cited in Chin is the employee has to act with the intent to further the employer's interest and not arise out of an impulse, external, independent, or personal motive. So you can do something that's wrong that you've been told not to do if you think you're actually doing it for the employer, but you decide you don't want to do it the way the employer tells you to do it. And yes, that's responding superior. But if you do something wrong, the employer told you not to do, and you don't do it for the employer's interest, albeit ill-guided, misguided, you do it for your own personal motive, then there's no responding superior. The problem you're having with our discussion is that the law is clear. The very allegation of employment relationship presumes this, and the burden of proof is on you. The only way you can win the argument, if you can win it at all, is to answer Justice Powell's question, which is go through the complaint and show how the plaintiff pleaded himself, herself, out of the presumption. Can you do that?
And again, maybe it's my failure in articulating what is in the complaint and what I believe or what I submit to the court should be in the complaint, which is, again, coming back to this, that there has to be, once the employer-employee relationship is established, there's nothing in the complaint that indicates that she's doing something for the employer, and I think that's necessary in addition to, I would submit that it's in addition to the allegation that there's an employer-employee relationship.
I asked your colleague about where the tort occurred, and that's a function of how I can't imagine how this works. Is it the access? Is it the dissemination? Is it somehow of some coordinated nature between the two of them? I've never been to a doctor's office where the receptionist wasn't somebody who's also doing insurance billings, for example. They have to fill out all the forms. They have to have access to what the treatment was, what diagnoses were. And so even identifying somebody as to they're a receptionist. Well, maybe they're a receptionist. Maybe they're also a billing assistant for insurance purposes. So it seems to me that it's just hard to have a rule that applies across the board to any particular employee until you have evidence as to what that employee does. But you get over that hurdle with the presumption, which is why the demur is probably not proper in this case.
Understood, Your Honor. And I think in this case, if we look at the three assignments of error, two deal with the dissemination. It's the first assignment of error where the plaintiff alleges that there was error to rule that Davis and Young are not liable for the dissemination of that information. They were never before the court, they never answered, they were never served. The vicarious liability part of the assignment there that we're discussing is also part of the dissemination piece. The second assignment of error, excuse me, Your Honor, the second assignment of error in this case is the access piece. And despite my colleague referencing Virginia statutory law, none is cited in the complaint. The access piece, this negligence per se piece, is on the access. The plaintiff, Mrs. Parker, is trying to make two separate negligence causes of action. Currently, you're negligent on not having safeguards in place, and that's negligence per se because of HIPAA. And then you're vicariously liable because of the dissemination they made. And so I think that's a dramatic distinction, Your Honor, in this case, is that the access piece that the plaintiff is relying on is access because HIPAA says you've got to have security measures in place. But there's no common law duty that you can point, that the plaintiff can point to in any court that says a healthcare provider has a common law duty to put safeguards in place as it relates to medical records. Certainly there's a common law duty as it relates to dissemination, and that comes out of the INOVA case. But vicarious liability through the INOVA case, Your Honor, is clearly from the employer authorizing the disclosure. The INOVA case is risk management authorizes records of a patient that never gave authorization to be distributed.
Are you familiar with any case law that has allowed the Curtis tort doctrine to apply to the safeguarding error, even in situations where respondent superior would not exist for the unauthorized personal motive release of information disclosure by an employee? In other words, Curtis was a disclosure tort. Is there any authority for going beyond the disclosure tort?
No, Your Honor. There's no authority that I'm aware of that applies a duty to the safeguarding aspect.
In instances where the disclosure would not trigger respondent superior anyway because it was unauthorized and personal motive.
Correct, Your Honor.
And then at the back end, if you start, the disclosure tort provides the incentive to have some policies, employee discipline, computer protocols in place. But the problem is, at the back end, you're going to have malpractice claims if doctors, nurses, et cetera, don't have access to the information they need to provide the care.
Well, correct, Your Honor, and that's why when in our brief we talked about the HIPAA piece. That's a regulatory. There are regulatory fines imposed upon them. You have to balance emergent and immediate access to a record that a doctor needs versus the balance of patient privacy, and that is a decision that is done in HIPAA by regulators. There are $50,000 fines possible for these, up to $1.5 million.
I think one of the bases, if you will, on which the appellant based his argument may have been a line out of ANOVA. And tell me what you think we meant. It says, in our jurisprudence, a healthcare provider owes a duty of reasonable care to the patient. Included within that duty is the healthcare provider's obligation to preserve the confidentiality of information. Is that access or is that disclosure?
No, Your Honor, I think that's clearly disclosure. And it builds on the Pierce case where the allegation was that a physician gaining private information of a patient then disclose that. I don't think those line of cases have anything to do with access. My time is out. Thank you all for your time and appreciate your consideration.
Rebuttal?
Yeah. May it please the court. Going to the point that was just discussed, the quote did say the duty is to preserve confidentiality. And I think the concept of preserving confidentiality has to include safeguarding the records from disclosure. Or
has there ever been a case that held a healthcare provider liable in tort under the Curtis Doctrine or analogous doctrine where the unauthorized disclosure does not trigger respondeat superior liability, but that the employer is still held liable despite that because of inadequate safeguarding allegations?
I do not know any factual situation where that has been adjudicated.
Well, that's a pretty big deal because HIPAA is a federal statute and there's probably, 30 or 40 HIPAA statutes across the states. And if there's no case doing that, that would be breaking some pretty new ground for us.
Well, I mean, the HIPAA statute clearly says that the duty to preserve confidentiality includes safeguarding.
It's a statute. We're not dealing with a statutory cause of action. We're dealing with a tort cause of action.
I understand, but I think negligence per se incorporates the statute and the regulation, would be my answer to that. And I think that just on what the court held in the Fairfax Hospital case, that the duty to preserve confidentiality, I think, has to include preservation is broad. Preserving confidence is broad. I think it has to include safeguarding. I think also, I see I'm running out of time, but I think the Virginia law for 96 years, ever since the Davis versus Merrill case, has been expansive on the respondeat superior. I think the Jenna Chen case reaffirmed that as well as other cases. I do not think that Carilion argued below that the complaint was vague in any way. In conclusion, I think that there's a great danger here if for all of us, if our health information is not protected under the law. And I ask that you
thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 5 minutes to 11.
All rise.